This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. This week, New Hampshire's Executive Council considered whether to continue funding Planned Parenthood amid national controversy over secretly taped videos by pro-life activists. Governor Maggie Hassan, who supported the contracts, had this to say to the councilors before the vote.
I find it very, very troubling that anyone would vote against these contracts just because the national political climate's a little difficult.
Nonetheless, the council voted 3-2 along party lines to reject state funding for Planned Parenthood. Republican Councilor Chris Sununu, who had previously supported Planned Parenthood funding, sided with his party to reject the contracts.
Things are different right now. We have to take a step back and just take a pause and say, is this a company and a business we should be actively engaging in?
And although he didn't make it into the official primary debate in Cleveland Thursday night, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina made one of the more memorable comments at the Voters First Forum Monday in Manchester.
As to the Clintons, I've been dealing with this crowd for 20 years. I'm fluent in Clinton speak. You want me to translate, Jack? When he says, Bill says, I didn't have sex with that woman, he did. When she says, I'll tell you about building the pipeline when I get to be president, means she won't.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have a panel with us for the hour to look at all the stories of the week. But first, we turn to NHPR's Chris Jensen, who's been covering this week's tragedy in Lancaster, as well as a recent development regarding the Northern Pass proposal. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, good morning, Brady.
Let's start with that news in Lancaster. You've talked to some of the people who were in the tent when it collapsed, and how did they describe exactly what happened that night?
Well, Brady, that night I talked to Julie Fuller of Lunenburg. She was in the tent with her 2-year-old daughter, and they went in for a fun evening. She said they'd been watching the show for about 15 minutes or so, and then suddenly the storm hit. The tent flap started blowing around, and then she said everything came down. Now, you know, this isn't a pup tent. The stuff that came down included heavy steel and wood supports. And Fuller said it was, quote, a scary movie gone bad, bad, very bad. She said it was absolute chaos with everybody trying to get out. And she said she couldn't believe that she wasn't hurt, and actually her daughter only had a small cut.
And there were quite a few people who described their injuries as minor, but there was a significant number of the people who were inside the tent who reported at least some sort of injury, not to mention the father and daughter who were killed there.
Right.
An unusually strong storm that moved through the area, that obviously a part of what happened. But the state has also been looking at whether the tent was properly set up.
Brady, that's exactly right. That's the whole focus of the investigation, and that's being led by the state's chief fire marshal, Bill Degg. Clinton's challenge is he's trying to figure out what the tent looked like before the storm ripped it to pieces. And he's stuck doing that reconstruction, well, largely because there was no safe inspection. The state does require a place of assembly permit, and it was the circus's responsibility to ask the Lancaster Fire Department for an inspection, but it didn't. Degnan said they just went ahead and put on the show. He was repeatedly asked whether the fire department or town officials should have taken the initiative. But he wasn't going there. He kept saying, oh, it's the town, it's not the town's responsibility. he also said that the first responders' expertise is rescuing people, and you know that those who responded Monday night did a great job and saved lives. But that remark suggests that small departments are not trained for issues such as structural inspections, and you know that raises a statewide question of whether New Hampshire needs to make some changes. Degnan was asked about that, and he wasn't making any promises, but he said, oh, that's something we'll be looking at.
The company that was running this event, Walker Brothers International, had planned to run several more events in the state, but in light of the tragedy, they decided to cancel those events. So, again, like you mentioned, there is a question of whether towns are ready for a situation of this magnitude. This Florida company, Walker Brothers International, what do we know about them now, and what have they been saying about what happened in Lancaster?
Well, that's surprisingly, they haven't been saying anything to reporters. They haven't been returning calls. And interestingly, initially, the company declined to cooperate with investigators, saying that they weren't going to say anything until they consulted their lawyer. That quickly changed within about a day, and Degnan said they were allowing all of their employees to be interviewed. And again, this was trying to find out what happened before and during the collapse. As for additional shows, at the request of state officials, the company decided to cancel its remaining events in New Hampshire. And I asked Degnan. Degnan said, well, no, there's no proof yet that the circus was at fault. But he noted the investigation wasn't over, and basically officials didn't want to take any chances.
So they have plenty of questions then going forward, the investigators.
Yes, and as Degnan describes it, what they're trying to do is to piece together a very detailed picture of what the tent looked like before the storm. So in addition to interviewing those circus employees, they had a structural engineer out to examine the wreckage. They took aerial photos. They had the National Weather Service look at the area. And they're also interviewing as many people who were in the tent as they can find.
Let's turn for a moment to another issue that you've been covering in detail, the proposal for Northern Pass. And the question of whether to bury the lines versus whether to use electric towers has been a big part of this debate for a long time. And there have been new developments in recent days.
Yeah, Brady, that's been a huge development. The Department of Energy put the draft of its environmental impact statement on its website. And that report's supposed to evaluate the effect of Northern Pass and look at possible alternatives. And that includes burying the line. And that's, of course, something that opponents have argued for years should and could be done. And for years, Northern Pass has said, no, it's too much of a challenge. It's too expensive. But opponents were, I think, pretty much thrilled with the DOE's conclusion that burying a less powerful line along state roads is both, quote, practical and technically feasible. But it's not cheaper. DOE estimated it would cost about $1.8 billion to bury all of the line, and that's $800 million more than using the big towers that Northern Pass wants. It's also far less than what Northern Pass has said burial would cost. But it should be noted that the Northern Pass was talking about burying a 1,200-megawatt line, and the DOE's figures are based on a 1,000-megawatt line, which is more commonly buried. The report's out there now, and the DOE is taking comments on it. And in October, it's going to hold public hearings in Concord, Plymouth, and Whitefield. There's no hearing in the far north country around Colebrook, and that's angered some folks.
All right, Chris, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Brady.
That's NHPR's Chris Jensen giving us the latest on both the proposal on Northern Pass and the latest on the tragedy in Lancaster. You'll find all of his coverage on both stories at NHPR.org. With us for the hour here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, Kevin Landrigan, Chief Political Correspondent for New Hampshire One News. Kevin, great to have you.
Thanks, Brady. Good to be here.
Rick Stevens, Northern New England Correspondent for the Associated Press. Good to have you as well, Rick.
Thanks for having me, Brady.
And Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, you've been with us for most of the week, so it's great to have you on this show as well.
Hi. Good morning, Brady.
Just to follow up on these two stories with each of you, Kevin, I was talking with someone in southern New Hampshire who organizes big outdoor public events, not quite the same as this circus in Lancaster, but even so, she said, this is the kind of thing that keeps me up at night. Nobody wants to make the wrong call about a situation like this, and certainly no one wants to see a tragedy unfold in a place like Lancaster, New Hampshire. But big questions coming out of this situation.
Yeah, there certainly are, and I think they really speak to how a small state like ours with a relatively small level of bureaucracy can construct a regulatory scheme, if you will, that can prevent things like this from happening, and if not prevent them, actually monitor these kind of events. it's no surprise, again, in a state like New Hampshire, there is no department of tent erection in New Hampshire that's going to inspect every tent before it's built. But to be sure, the law as it now stands is extremely vague and leaves it up to cities and towns to do whatever they wish to do. And of course, in this case, as Chris pointed out, not only was the town not consulted, but it doesn't appear as if town officials reached out to this company and said, hey, what's going on?
Rick.
Yeah, it's not just a New Hampshire thing. Kevin, you're exactly right. The low level of bureaucracy in the state does sort of throw up a handicap. But I did some reporting yesterday talking with other states, both in the area and then out in the Midwest. I talked to a couple of states. I talked to an outdoor amusement industry guy in Florida. And these regs are all over the map everywhere. Sometimes the state mandates it. Sometimes the state does it themselves. Sometimes it's the locality. Sometimes there's no regulation for inspection. And the other wrinkle, sometimes these fire usually it's a fire marshal or a building inspector. Sometimes they don't have the expertise to say, hey, this tent was put up correctly. They're going in, they're looking for obvious damage. They're looking for missing emergency lights. Are the aisles wide enough? Do they have enough exits? So they might be able to inspect the tent and still have the same outcome. And the other thing we need to remember, and Brady, you mentioned it, this was a massive wind blast, gusts up to 75 miles an hour. You know, even if it had been constructed perfectly well, who can tell what happens with a 75-mile-an-hour wind?
And Dean, on Northern Pass, does this finding where the federal officials are saying the costs wouldn't be what Eversource is claiming, and Eversource, by the way, has disputed the methodology that the federal government has used to come up with those numbers. But does that finding perhaps change the dynamic about what this proposed project might look like if it's approved, which is still an open question at this point?
Well, I think that this draft Department of Energy study certainly has opened the door to kind of shift the focus to a lot of these other alternatives. But you know, I got to tell you that the reaction to this by this report by both sides has been very instructive. You know, Eversource said, look, see, the report says this is going to be incredibly expensive to bury lines. And the opponents say, look, see, it's actually not that much more expensive to bury all the lines. So we're sort of right back where we were to begin with. And I think there's like a 60-day public comment period, and then we'll get the final version of this. But, you know, I think both sides are going to continue to dig in on this. But at a minimum, the report has opened up a broader discussion of this idea of a 1,000-megawatt line instead of 1,200 megawatts and, you know, some other alternative pathways. But I think this is going to be going on for a while.
And coming up, we'll talk about another issue with broad implications that has a national controversy over Planned Parenthood and implications for New Hampshire. Join us with your comments at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Stay with us for more of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange from New Hampshire Public Radio. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week with Kevin Landrigan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Let's turn our attention next to a big story in state government this week. New Hampshire's Executive Council has voted against two state contracts for Planned Parenthood. Kevin, could you walk us through the dynamics of the council vote here? Because it was a split vote along party lines.
Yes, it was, Brady. And certainly with the national undercover video by an anti-abortion group that had a national Planned Parenthood official discussing with someone the, if not the sale, the donation of fetal body parts, that certainly changed a lot of the tension and emotion at the council table. Chris Sununu, as your opening pointed out, ended up being the decisive vote to reject the contracts. He had supported Planned Parenthood in the past. All three Republicans opposing the contracts and the two Democrats on the council supporting them. One of the points that Councilor Sununu made, which he also made when he supported Planned Parenthood 4 years ago, was that there wasn't enough choice in terms of family planning providers, that in light of this scandal at the national level, he says he's heard from constituents that want to choose a provider other than Planned Parenthood, yet they don't have access to one in his district. So that was one of the reasons why he rejected the contract and urged the governor to work with him to try and identify other providers in the future.
One of the issues that people on both sides of that debate seemed to agree on was that the national videos prompted the change in the dynamic of this debate. And Jennifer Frizzell of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England spoke yesterday with All Things Considered host Peter Biello. And here's what she had to say about this vote in the executive council.
Has been some clinical and dispassionate language used in these videos for which we have honestly apologized as an organization. That's not the way we approach our patients. It's not the kind of care we want to be known for. And we've been honest and transparent when anyone has asked about investigating. However, the individuals behind the videos are really trying to manufacture wrongdoing, and there's no uncovering of wrongdoing that's been identified by anyone who's viewed the videos in their entirety.
Dean Spiliotis, that was Jennifer Frizzell of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England talking about saying this national debate over these videos involving the national organization Planned Parenthood is what's really going on here. And in a separate interview that Peter Biello had with Councillor Sununu, he said, look, even though there's no evidence that the Northern New England organization was involved, Planned Parenthood is Planned Parenthood, and the state needs to consider carefully who it's doing business with.
Yeah, you know, it's as we heard in the clip, the issue here is one of you know, kind of the tone of these videos, these edited videos, versus whether or not there's some sort of illegality here in terms of how they're running their fetal tissue donation program. And I think that the Planned Parenthood of Northern New England does not participate in that program. But nonetheless, Chris Sununu has said, you know, he has said he's pro-choice. For him, this is not an issue of pro-choice versus pro-life. This is an issue of kind of business practices and whether or not the state should be doing business with this particular organization. And he had asked Governor Hassan to have the state attorney general look into things as is happening in some other states. But, you know, also, you know, there's sort of the political overlay here of the next governor's race. And he was just in a very difficult position. You think about, you know, even though he's pro-choice, voting in favor of these contracts and then having to potentially go into a Republican primary next September. It might be a little problematic for how he deals with conservatives in the party who are very upset about this. And as I said, you know, we've seen at the national level Republicans, even though the initial attempts in the Senate to defund, I believe, were blocked, it's going to keep coming back. It'll come back up again in the fall, I believe. So it's not going away. So, you know, Chris Sununu was in a difficult position. You know, there's the whole issue of the relationship between the Northern New England organization and the national organization, and that just the kind of public relations problem posed by just the tone of these videos, which even as we heard from Jennifer Frizzell has said they understand that was problematic, whether or not there's actually anything illegal going on.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Emily is calling from Concord. Hi, Emily. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead with your question.
I wanted to comment on the fact that it's frustrating that our executive council is making these decisions based on this fetal tissue donation program, but New Hampshire doesn't participate in that. There's only very, very few organizations that actually do this tissue donation. So it's disheartening to hear that they're going to stop healthcare for a lot of women in the state that don't otherwise have access. And I'm just curious, you know, where are they going to make up for the shortcomings? Where are they going to give these women a chance to have their health care taken care of in a safe way throughout the state?
It's a great question, Emily, and thanks so much for joining us. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Rick, we did get one answer to Emily's question yesterday when Councillor Sununu talked with All Things Considered, and he said, despite this vote in the state contracts with Planned Parenthood, he said, and despite claims from Governor Hassan and Democrats, he said, no one's actually going to lose any coverage here. It's just more a statement that the state needs to take a step back. And so that was his contention.
That's right. But, you know, Emily makes a fair point. It's a good chunk of money that comes out of Planned Parenthood's annual budget. I think it's a third of their public funding, $640,000 or something like that. And if you look at across the national level, you're talking about real big money and big numbers of patients who are served. Planned Parenthood, I think, serves some 12,000 patients in the state. There are other providers that the council, they approved, I think, $1 million worth of contracts for other health care providers. But she raises a fair point there.
Kevin, this is not the first time that the executive council has voted against a Planned Parenthood contract. That happened in 2011. The circumstances, though, weren't quite the same.
No, they weren't. And certainly after the 2010 election, you'll recall the Republicans got a supermajority not only in the legislature but also at the executive council table. And that's one of the reasons why, back to Rick's point, that Planned Parenthood continues to have this money. At that time, the council rejected Planned Parenthood. The federal government stepped in, the Obama administration, and essentially said, we don't need you, New Hampshire. We'll contract directly with Planned Parenthood. And that's what they've done ever since with the federal family planning grants for cancer screenings and STD testing and the like. All of that with federal money has been done directly with Washington, and the council's not been involved.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. If you'd like to join us with your comments and questions about the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, call us with your questions at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us emails, exchange@nhpr.org. We had plenty of presidential politics this week, both in New Hampshire and across the country. Last night, the Republican candidates for president took part in two debates. There was a primetime debate on Fox News for 10 candidates and an earlier forum for seven others who the debate organizers judged were too low in the polls to take part in the primetime event. But before that, the voters' first forum in New Hampshire with 14 GOP candidates. We'll get to the substance of each of these events in just a moment. But first, let's talk, Dean, about the structure and the format, because the approaches between the New Hampshire event and the one in Cleveland were quite different.
That's right. And in fact, the New Hampshire event was in some sense a response to the Cleveland event and the limitations placed on who would be on stage when by Fox News. And so the Monday event it was open to anyone who wanted to participate. So in theory, we could have had all 17 there. We ended up having 14. And it was basically two rounds of sort of fairly quick questioning, 5 to 8 minutes a person. And then the next person would come up in this. A lot of people referred to it as speed dating. That was kind of the social media buzz, was that it was Republican candidate speed dating. And then, the events last night in Cleveland, they split the field 10 in the main event at 9 p.m. and 7 in the earlier debate for people who were not in the top 10 based on an average of a number of polls. And there was a lot of controversy about this, about whether or not there could have been some other way to randomize the field and split it up into two groups. But nonetheless, Fox went ahead and did this, 7 people at 5 p.m. and then 10 people at 9 p.m. And it's a little problematic because everybody started referring to the first debate as the undercard or the JV or the kids'
table.
Some people called it happy hour. And the reality is there are a lot fewer people watching at 5 p.m., particularly as you go out in time zones than at 9 p.m. But on the other hand, the name of the game really is kind of, media coverage and social media buzz. So for some of the people in that earlier debate, I think in the end it'll end up helping them nonetheless.
The formats were different. As you mentioned, speed dating was the style in New Hampshire. Not that much interaction between the candidates taking part in the forum here in New Hampshire, but plenty of interaction encouraged by many of the moderators during the events last night. We have a clip of some interaction between Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey and Kentucky U.S. Senator Rand Paul talking about government surveillance when it comes to security and anti-terrorism. And so let's hear what they had to say to each other.
Senator, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that you use the system the way it's supposed to work.
Here's the problem, Governor. You fundamentally misunderstand the Bill of Rights. Every time you did a case, you got a warrant from a judge. I'm talking about searches without warrants, indiscriminately of all Americans' records, and that's what I fought to end. I don't trust President Obama with our records. I know you gave him a big hug, and if you want to give him a big hug again, go right ahead.
And
go ahead, Governor.
And Senator Paul, the hugs that I remember are the hugs that I gave to the families who lost their people on September 11th.
That's Chris Christie talking with Rand Paul at last night's Fox News debate in Cleveland, Ohio. Rick Stevens, you would not have heard an interaction like that given the format at Monday's event here in New Hampshire.
No, not at all. There was really no interaction, I don't think. I don't think they directly engage each other. And one of the things I found interesting, the GOP went into this debate season sort of still stinging a little bit from the last cycle when they bashed Romney around pretty good and they thought it hurt him in the general. So they went into this season with sort of a, you know, draw no blood hope. And, of course, that didn't happen last night in Ohio. There was pointed exchanges. That was a great one between Christie and Paul. But there were others. Donald Trump certainly got involved with some of the bashing back and forth. But the gloves are off. And it looks like 2012 is back in 2016.
So. And, Rick, I really think that was a function of the questioning of the Fox anchors. Mm-hmm. Their format typically was candidate X. In the past, you've said such and such about candidate Y, and so then they're right there on the stage.
Please
with each
turn
other.
To him.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
the
questions were very constraining. You either had to sort of take the bait or just go off in a completely different direction. So we saw a number of examples like that Christie Rand Paul exchange where they got into it as a result of the way the question shaped the discussion.
It was obvious too that unlike other debates, Fox engaged the crowd in this.
Which was not, you know, they didn't
debate.
Tell them to be quiet. It was,
they didn't, was, not only didn't yeah. tell them to be quiet, yeah. Dean, before the debate started, they said, now you can comment if you wish yeah. to whatever candidates say. Just make sure it's somewhere between, I think they mentioned a LeBron dunk at that basketball stadium and a mouse hearing a pin drop.
And I think the candidates feed off of that.
I absolutely did. And it helped some candidates and it clearly hurt others.
But one thing that I did notice, Kevin, was is that there were candidates who, when asked to, you know, John Kasich, for example, at one point was asked, you know, speak about Donald Trump. And Kasich didn't go there. He said, look, Donald Trump and I disagree about things, but I'm not going to get into an attack with Donald Trump. And what I think that said to me was that in a way that perhaps wasn't true as much in 2012, there is a fair bit of policy disagreement among some of the candidates on some issues in 2016. There's a candidate, for example, in the Republican field who's for improving the minimum wage. There are candidates who are for certain kinds of immigration overhauls. There are some who are not. And so you are seeing some policy disagreements as well as the stylistic disagreements or who's more conservative and who isn't.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And to be sure, I think most of the candidates last night understood that it was Fox's job to bloody Donald Trump up and Fox did a pretty good job of it.
And I think after the first round of questioning, the adrenaline kind of burned off a little bit. And there was a fair bit of policy discussion, particularly in the second hour of the debate.
Dean, I wanted to ask you a little bit because I know you watched the entire marathon, essentially,
of
the debates. And,
yes, I did.
And of the people who were involved in the first forum, the one that seemed to get at least online a lot of the attention was Carly Fiorina, someone who has spent a lot of time in New Hampshire and someone who some rank-and-file Republicans here have been paying a lot of attention to and are surprised she hasn't made more of an impact in the field yet.
Yeah, and I think that was the hope for people in that first debate, that you'd come out of that with a lot of attention on social media and reporting, et cetera, that you did a really good job. And that certainly happened for her. And there were, you know, a couple big challenges with that first debate. The initial one was there's no audience, as we were just talking about with Kevin. It was a dark arena with a few staffers sitting in chairs and a kind of echoey sounding. And then the second thing was a lot of these candidates in that first round were confronted with some variant of the following question. You used to be a rising star. You used to be in first place. You're no longer there. Why are you running? Mr. Jindal, Mr. Perry, Mr. Pataki, Mr. Santorum. So it really kind of put them in a tough spot. And I think Carly Fiorina got some good buzz coming out of that as a result.
Dean, I wonder if Carly Fiorina's good buzz, too, comes from her approach to this so far, at least in the past couple of weeks. You know, we use the fight analogy an awful lot. The gloves are off or they're in the ring. But she actually uses the words, they need somebody to punch back at Hillary Clinton, the presumptive. Well, I better not say that yet. It's a little early. But the big player on the Democratic side. So she says, we need to punch back and pull no punches. So she's – and I think that resonates with members of that party.
And Hillary Clinton did take a fair bit of heat in both debates, particularly in that first debate. Senator Lindsey Graham won after her extensively, as he has pretty much all along, even going back to the forum on Monday. But sure, you know, she's sort of very focused. She's a very good communicator, and this may be an opportunity for her to – to get a second look, which may get her into the top tier in a subsequent debate.
Some of that rhetoric that she used repeatedly in both events here in New Hampshire and in Ohio, the political class has let you down and that I'm the person who can challenge the status quo. So rhetoric that seems to be resonating with at least some people. Kevin, one question I had for you was, given that 11 of the 14 candidates who were in the Voters First Forum were physically here, there were three who were in Washington because of a Senate vote, I was surprised at how few of them held other events in the state before or after that debate. A few did. Rick Perry was here, Scott Walker, Carly Fiorina stopped by her post-debate party. But most of the others came in for the forum and then went elsewhere.
Yeah, I think largely that was a function of how quickly this forum came together. You'll recall it was only in the planning stages less than a month from start to finish. So I think a lot of candidates already had their schedules for this particular week pretty well set up. And for many of them, they wanted to spend time preparing for this Fox News debate on Thursday night.
What are the Democrats saying about about these Republican debates, Dean?
Well, you know, it's sort of predictable. I think I read that Hillary Clinton said something like, you know, every time I watch these debates, I'm astounded what the GOP candidates have to say. So, you know, and if you sort of followed along on a Twitter feed, you could kind of see a lot of the sort of snarkiness, et cetera. But, you know, the Democrats will have their own opportunities with their debates coming up in the fall, although they're going to have six instead of the Republican nine. So even fewer. And that in itself has become a little bit of a kind of a mini story among Democrats.
Yeah, there was Martin O'Malley, in particular, the former governor of Maryland, Kevin, was saying, look, we need to have more debates. Six is simply not enough, especially given that they're taking place so close to the end of this year, so close to when voters are actually going to start casting votes.
Yeah, the schedule had come out actually yesterday, a number of hours before the Fox News debate. And the schedule only came out because Martin O'Malley the day before in Iowa was very critical of the Democratic leadership, as you point out, that there were only going to be six debates. We knew that and have known that for a number of months. But he also pointed out that there were only going to be one in Iowa and one in New Hampshire and felt there should be many more than that. Also, the timing of these. New Hampshire's debate is scheduled 6 days before Christmas, which is going to be at least 6 weeks, probably 2 months before we actually vote. And as we know in New Hampshire, we're infamous for making up our minds pretty late in the game.
Last minute. Well, we, in just a few minutes, will continue this conversation. We have callers on the line. Please stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. A quick email from one of our listeners. Ryan wrote in to say, I am a Republican. I watched both GOP debates last night. He continues, his words, circus, a six-hour circus. I wish Dr. Carson, Ben Carson, was given more time and Trump, Donald Trump, less. Trump can win the nomination, and I am troubled. Some thoughts from Ryan there. Thanks so much for your email, Ryan. And Chris is calling from Kittery, Maine. Hi, Chris. You're on the exchange.
Hi, good morning, Brady. Good morning, panel. Quick question I haven't heard addressed in any media yet. If Hillary Clinton receives a party's nomination to run for president next year, who does the panel speculate that she would choose as a running mate and why?
That looked, Kevin, at one point like that was going to be about the only question in the Democratic field, who Hillary Clinton was going to choose as her running mate after she secured the nomination. And we have a very different nomination contest going on in that we have a nominating contest going on. There was a recent poll once again showing that Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, is running fairly well against Hillary Clinton, at least here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, that's true, and is doing well in a number of the other early states, drawing big crowds. But as we know in the Republican campaign as well, it's very early at this stage to conclude that this race is either going to be ultra-competitive or that Hillary Clinton's not going to have much of a contest at all at the end of the day towards the nomination. As for her running mate, she's not said anything about that, and I don't expect she'll have much to say about that until at least she's sewed up the nomination if she's able to get it.
Chris, thanks so much for that question. Dean, and one more question to you before we move on. I did note that during the Voters First Forum in Manchester, a lot of the Republican candidates made a point of criticizing Hillary Clinton, and a few made a point of criticizing Vice President Joe Biden, who is at least thus far, not a part of this race. Mm-hmm. No mentions that I heard of Bernie Sanders and no mentions of Martin O'Malley or Lincoln Chafee or Jim Webb.
Yeah, I mean, they continue in general. They continue to proceed as though Hillary Clinton is the likely nominee. There was this little kind of subplot in the last week about Joe Biden possibly gearing up to run for president, or at least taking a look at it. There's been some competing reporting on that from different outlets. Not clear at this point at all that he would get into the race, or that it would, you know, sort of fundamentally sort of change the dynamics in terms of sort of how competitive the Democrats would be in November of 2016. But, you know, it's possible. But it seems to me everybody is pretty much focused on Hillary Clinton at this point.
Lots to keep up on in the world of politics, but we're going to take a look at some of the other New Hampshire news of the week. And here's a story from just yesterday. Newington-based Planet Fitness has launched its initial public offering. It's now trading on the New York Stock Exchange. And joining us now with the latest on Planet Fitness is Bob Sanders, who's been covering this story for the New Hampshire Business Review. Great to talk with you, Bob.
Great to be here.
To start, how did day one go for Planet Fitness?
So-so. As I said, they're kind of like it was like on a treadmill. They ran and they were running in place. They start out at $16 per share. That's what it opened at, and that's what it closed at.
Yeah, that was $14 to $16 is what everyone was expecting it, and they went for $16. They went at the high end of that
right.
range.
They were hoping for there's some other fitness, including a wearable fitness stock, Fitbit, that did very well, and they were hoping that all hype about the fitness stocks was going to propel it, and it didn't. It could have done worse, though. It could have gone down. So
it held its own and could try again today, I guess. Right. It's very, right. very to use an exercise metaphor. Now, Planet Fitness has been growing pretty quickly over the last few years. It's been adding hundreds of new locations in 2014 and in 2013. It just passed 1,000 overall. It claims over 7 million members, but compared to its plans going forward, that's actually looks small compared to what it's hoping to achieve. What are the goals for Planet Fitness that this IPO is part of?
Well, it was saying that they want to really grow fast. They need to grow fast because a lot of their money is selling equipment. They sell the equipment to the Planet Fitnesses, and that's 44%, almost half of their money comes from that.
They sell the equipment to the franchisees.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But once you sell them the equipment, they got to open another store to sell equipment to the next one. So they need to grow rapidly. 4,000, I think, was their high end, but they're hoping to do that. They're trying to go international, and but the peculiar thing is that the capital is not being used for that. The money they're raising, which is about $200 million, is going to this private equity firm that owns them. In other words, it's just profit for the investors who bought this thing 3 years ago for about $500 million. And now it's theoretically worth $1.6 billion, and that $200 million is to pay that stock. I suppose that they hope that they'll get more financing through maybe future offerings or future sales of stock. They have a lot of debt and they don't have much cash, so I'm not sure how they're going to grow that quickly. And as some people pointed out, they might have competition. I mean, so other people might catch on to the idea that offering a cheap membership and not encouraging people to come that much will mean that you have a lot of members and in each store, and that makes a lot of money for each store, and that's one of the reasons people like the franchise like to make a go of it.
Yeah, so I was talking with an analyst yesterday who said on Forbes.com that, look, if you take some of the other low-cost chains that, you know, they aren't on the scale of Planet Fitness, but if you take those chains, put them all together, they have about 4,000 locations, what Planet Fitness has said it's a high end of growth that it might like to achieve. But it took those chains decades to get to that point, and here you have Planet Fitness talking about a very rapid expansion. So it raises the question, how realistic is that goal of rapid growth given all of these different factors?
Yeah, that's the question. They have been faster than a lot of the competition. But the question is, they say they're everybody else is for the 20% of the lunk heads or the
serious gym guy. People.
Yeah, and therefore the casual user. So you know, we're for the 80%. I mean, they might as well say for the 99%. But anyway, but not talking about money. They're talking about workouts.
Now, you broke a story about Planet Fitness and a lawsuit that involves what you described as a brotherly legal dispute. This is another factor in this this whole scenario.
Yeah, this was put out on a SEC filing like the day before the so it got totally lost, but we picked it up basically. And it, yes, the former founder, it was founded by two brothers, Michael and Mark Grundo, if I'm pronouncing it right. And one left, and that was Michael, when they sold out to this equity firm called TSG. And the other one stayed, and he's not the CEO. He's on the board. The CEO is Chris Rondo, so it's a very very confusing. But anyway, Michael apparently wants to renegotiate the deal when he left. He feels it wasn't fair or whatever. He had his lawyer contact them, and they say they're going to basically fight this, but they're starting with an arbitration clause. So there might be some tension. I don't think it's going to be the level of Market Basket, but there seems to be a little family dispute there.
Companies have to point these kinds of things out as they do these filings to note to potential investors. And here's something else that Planet Fitness noted as it was putting its IPO together. They said, we want New Hampshire to change its tax laws when it relates to companies that go public. Or, they said at that time, we will move our headquarters out of state. Now, that came up then in the legislature following, and that's still an open question, at least whether that end up, whether that will end up in the books in this state or not.
Yeah. First of all, the law, it was vetoed by the governor. But she opened it as part of negotiations for the budget. In fact, in her compromise proposal, she said, basically, we will give them a $14 million tax, give a $14 million tax break to these types of transactions. So that would be – that's on her budget, but that's up to negotiation. So she's willing to talk about it. Now, they just the union leader just talked to the CEO. Actually, we tried to talk to the CEO. For some reason, they canceled our interview. And Chris told the CEO that – he has no plans to move, but he has to take into account his stockholders. And actually, in the filing itself, it says that that one of the ways of that this tax situation they will need to deal with is by relocating our corporate headquarters. That's one of the things that they actually put in their filing with the SEC. So they actually have to consider this because they said they will. To the stockholders who are buying shares. So it's not just in the legislature, it's black and white.
It's right there, and so that means you've got plenty to keep you busy on this front for the time to come, right?
Oh, yeah. We have a lot to look at. There was just another filing today, and I'm going to have to get an extra cup of coffee to read it.
There you go. That's Bob Sanders. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Bob Sanders of the New Hampshire Business Review with the latest on this week's initial public offering from New Hampshire-based Planet Fitness. Joining us for the hour is Kevin Landergan of New Hampshire One News, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University and NHPoliticalCapital.com, and Rick Stevens of the Associated Press, and panelist Governor Hassan included, as Bob noted, a version of the so-called Planet Fitness proposal in her latest budget offering. And Kevin Landergan, we've heard recently that both the governor and Republican leaders in the state legislature have been talking. They say they'll continue to talk. But has there been any new development on those budget negotiations, if those negotiations are actually still taking place?
The negotiations are taking place in private, but we're not hearing a lot of progress is being made. And I don't think a lot of progress will be made until at least the end of August. That's because both sides are bitterly disagree over how the state ended the last fiscal year on June 30th. The governor maintains that there's essentially $40 million less from that prior budget year than the legislature thought there was when they put their budget together that the governor vetoed. Until that report comes out at the end of August, I don't think there's going to be much movement at all. That will at least tell all the parties. It'll be an unaudited report, but it will be a much more clear understanding of where the books were, that all sides can then operate going forward. Here's how much we have in surplus from the prior year to deal with the next two-year budget. I think then the real talks will begin.
One issue that had separated the two sides in these budget negotiations was the amount of funding for substance abuse treatment and prevention and so forth. And Governor Hassan took part in an event this week in Laconia with U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Rick, in which they both called for more funding. And they used the word bipartisan solution for this, which is always interesting.
Interesting and a little odd because in the next breath, when they said we need a bipartisan approach to substance abuse treatment, and we know that there's a growing heroin and opiate addiction problem in this country. So they say we need a bipartisan approach, and it's the Republicans' fault that we don't have the funding. They came out, both of them said, Governor Hassan said Republicans in the legislature had stymied these efforts, and Senator Shaheen said it was the GOP in Congress that did the same federally, cutting some $130 million out of a program for substance abuse treatment. So it was a little odd. Now, to Kevin's point, too, Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley very pointedly said, no, the governor is just plain wrong, and we need to see about that $40 million. We need to see where the overspending is before we can do anything about the next cycle's budget. So that's where they are. They're sort of dug in.
And in the meantime, Dean, we're still in the continuing resolution, at least for the time being.
That's right. And, you know, as Kevin was mentioning, it may be some time before we actually see any major progress. And, you know, the one of the political subplots here is this in some way preventing Governor Hassan from getting onto a Senate race against Kelly Ayotte? We don't know, but that's what people like to speculate about. But this may keep her busy for some time into the fall.
We have heard from several Republicans that the fact that it's a continuing resolution, that funding continues at last year's levels, has affected some programs.
Right.
Some are losing out, and substance abuse being one of them.
That's right.
And speaking of drug issues, Manchester, the city of Manchester, was looking to use some funding, not state funding, but to use funding for a drug court. And the governor's office said, actually, that won't work. What was behind that?
Mayor Ted Gatzis had asked the governor about declaring a public emergency on the heroin epidemic, and then about using this $2.5 million. It's a federal grant, and the governor's office said it can't be used for that purpose. But she, at the same time, and I believe it was at the event with Senator Shaheen in Laconia, where she said, this $5.9 million that I've put back in substance abuse will help you get your drug court in Manchester, Mayor Gatzis. So she sort of addressed it in that vein. Mayor Gatzis was also looking for some other things that he's put his own plan out to try and combat the drug issue, including a prevention program, Dropbox that you can throw your unused prescription medicines in, and this drug court. Which the governor says will be able to go forward if this $5.9 million is approved.
Yeah, one of the things about the drug courts and these federal grants is Washington is willing to support this kind of activity, but they want to see commitment or buy-in at the local level. And that's the problem Mayor Ted Gatzis has. You'll recall in June, the Hillsborough County delegation voted against the money to set up a drug court in Manchester. A number of Republican legislators there in the county delegation who aren't from Manchester essentially asked the question, you know, why are our property taxes going to go up to support a drug court that may be 20, 30 miles away from my district? So Mayor Gatzis essentially needs to get that buy-in either from the city budget or from the county budget in order to get the federal grant. That's how these grants have been awarded in the past. And in most communities across the state that have had these, there's about a half dozen drug courts, they've all utilized this county tax money. Why is that? Because it's all property tax money after all. But if it doesn't come from my city budget or my town budget, it doesn't look as if I'm raising the taxes to pay for it.
It's been quite a week in New Hampshire, especially given the fact that it's August and we have this much news going on. Unfortunately, we're out of time for this hour. But as we wrap up, I'll just ask each of you, what stories are you going to be watching next week? And I'll start with you, Kevin Landrigan.
Presidential politics, to be sure. Now that the debate is over, we're going to see a lot of them. We're also continuing to monitor this continuing resolution. Senate committees have been created to look at the impact of the continuing resolution on Department of Health and Human Services. They're planning a meeting on that. It could be by the end of next week.
Rick Stevens.
I've got an interesting look at John Daniels, a seminary student from Keene who 50 years ago was killed in Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement. And his presence still resonates today. So,
and Dean Spiliotis.
I'm going to continue to look at the political fallout of the Executive Council vote on the Planned Parenthood contract. Going to continue to follow presidential politics is heating up. And I should also mention you can now follow me on Twitter, at Dean Spiliotis. I may be the last political analyst in the country to get on, but you can now find me there, at Dean Spiliotis.
Glad to have you aboard. The Twitter handle for this program, by the way, is at NHPR Exchange. Kevin Landergan of New Hampshire One News, Rick Stevens of the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. Great to have you, as always.
Thanks, Brady.
Thanks, Brady.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Mike. Our intern is Noah Bunnell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.